This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Our man in Glasgow, Anatole, is attending COP26. He's at the Conservative Environment Network gathering. It's a building. It's a very handsome building in Glasgow, as all the buildings in Glasgow are. This was the center of industrialization when we were not a nation. This is the organizing principle of what we consider to be modern economics. This is Adam Smith territory. So Anatole's at the beginning of the story, the industrialization of the West and the world that led to where we are right now. Anatole is also the author of a history of how we got to here, Climate Change and the Nation State, The Case for Nationalism in a Warming World. We turn to statements in these last hours that I need help interpreting. This is Bloomberg Green, Eric Rosten reporting. The U.S. and China's climate pact late on Wednesday night, in other words, within these last hours, changed the dynamics at high-stakes COP26 talks. It was a surprise statement for two powers that have been at odds throughout the meeting and locked for years in geopolitical rivalry. Anatole, I come to you because it was a surprise. It came in late. We were gloomy about inflation here and in the UK. I think their word is stagflation in the UK, but that's another challenge we'll have. And then came this announcement. How do you interpret these remarks? Because the cynic in me, and I make mistakes not to bring him out every once in a while, says that promises. How do you hear this, Anatole?
Well, the Biden administration is trying, I think, at least rhetorically, to live up to what it has always said about China and Russia, which is that we will criticize them and compete with them toughly, you know, where our values and interests diverge, but we will try to cooperate with them where our interests converge and where, you know, essential human needs require this, which is, of course, above all, climate change. So they're trying to follow through on that. But, of course, the question is, as you say, I mean, whether anything concrete can come of this. And there are two areas where if it's going to mean anything, it has to happen. But where, you know, the whole wider rhetoric and strategy of competition and rivalry makes it very difficult. One is technology sharing. And by the way, I mean, this is true for both sides. I mean, the Chinese are really not good at sharing their technology either. But in a whole range of areas, you know, if you want real cooperation and progress, the two sides have to be prepared to share their technology rather than pursuing the strategy which China has pursued for many years and which the US is now under Biden trying to imitate, which is, no, we want to dominate the, for example, renewable energy markets of the future. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, look, I've always taken the line, in so many countries of the world, if China can bring prosperity, growth, and therefore political stability, and prevent new crises, for God's sake, let them. That's good for all of us, you know, especially in areas where we have completely failed to do so. In large parts of Africa, for example, don't see this as a competition. Don't see it as necessarily even a gain for China, because some of these places you wouldn't give to your worst enemy, right? But, you know, look at China and the West together building resilience in these countries whose collapse would be a disaster for us all. Unfortunately, once again, at the present, this is very much being seen as a rivalry for influence and economic power in Africa and so on. There have been some good moves. China has committed itself not to support coal burning projects abroad, which was a big gap in, you know, in China's climate change commitments. That was a good first step on their side. Let's see where it goes from here.
I go to methane. I can do both. The English languages are chrysalis, but sometimes, because there is now confusion about it, given these late hour announcements by the U.S. and China that may include this, but I'll go to the report earlier in COP26. China signaled it's unlikely to join a global pledge to cut methane emissions, said it's already doing enough to reduce gases. The quote from Wang Yi, who is a major player at COP26 for China, Mr. Xi Jinping did not attend. The U.S. keeps telling people to join it for new pledges, but without giving solutions about how to tackle methane, said Wang Yi. Young people say there's a lot of blah, blah, blah here, which to some degree is true, he said, referring to the well-known teenager, Greta Thunberg. Anatole, methane, why is this now a major focus? And I note that this morning there's the odd report that there's been a methane release out of Alabama somewhere. It's odd, and they don't know the origin of it. But what is methane, specially, that everybody's concentrating on it?
Yeah. Well, the thing about methane is that it's, in the short term, it is, as a greenhouse gas, in other words, as a driver of climate change, it is almost 40 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, 38 times more powerful. Now, methane doesn't last so long in the atmosphere, but obviously while it lasts, thank God it disappears relatively quickly, but while it lasts, it can have a huge driving effect. Now, there are two areas where methane really comes in. One is, well, it's produced by all sorts of things, including cattle. But there is a lot of release of methane as a side effect of drilling for and transporting natural gas. Fracking produces a lot of methane. So while on the one hand people are holding out natural gas as the less polluting than oil, much less polluting than coal, bridge to a cleaner energy future, this tends to ignore the methane effect that goes with it. So all sorts of people are saying quite rightly, the United States and so many other countries, the countries of the Persian Gulf, you know, have to come up with solutions to the leakage of methane as a side effect of, you know, they're drilling for gas. But the apocalyptic threat of methane, which was highlighted, by the way, by Sir David King, a scientist at COP26, is this threat that the melting of the Arctic permafrost will release enormous quantities of methane. And a report that was issued at COP says that just that has the capacity, only the release of methane from the Arctic, has the capacity to raise global temperatures by 1.2 degrees, not over a century, but over a few years. Now, if that happens, you are, of course, you're not talking about 2.4, you're talking about 3.6 degrees of rise. Now, then we are heading for catastrophic territory by the end of the century, and a risk that climate change will escape totally from our control, and, you know, we will end up with basically the end of modern civilization. So that's why methane is so important.
The puzzle you just present is a question I have from speaking with the Siberian Times at Novosibirsk. Those fires in Yakutia we referenced, they not only produced poisonous gases, smoke, so much so they had to keep the children inside or evacuate them, but also the concern was that it was setting fire to the, if I understand correctly, the peat underneath the forest. And yep. that peat will burn through the wintertime, despite the snows, and that is part of melting or reducing the permafrost that releases the methane. Have I got that equation correct, Anatole?
Yep. That's absolutely right. So, you know, on the one hand, you have huge releases of carbon dioxide from the forest fires and from the smoldering peat fires, but you also have an increased melting of the permafrost with colossal releases of methane. I mean, and of course, all this also comes from the fact that warming in the Arctic, for a whole set of reasons I won't go into, is proceeding at between 2 and 3 times faster than in the planet as a whole. So the Arctic is an area that we really, really need to concentrate on. And by the way, I mean, one of the things I think that, you know, the US and China and Russia really need to talk about together and research together is the possibility of limited geoengineering only in the Arctic. To try to limit this, because of course, if we are ever forced to that, I hope we won't be, but we have to recognize the possibility. This is something which absolutely has to be done cooperatively, you know, between the major powers. If we get into competitive or rival geoengineering, you know, that we could drive, you know, even worse catastrophes.
Yes, I'm very attracted to geoengineering because it immediately reawakens my science fiction 11-year-old reading of what went wrong with this planet. You know, they tried an experiment and suddenly everybody looks like a giraffe and nobody can swim, you know, something like that. So I ran across in the Economist magazine a report that there's an experiment proposed to release small amounts of detritus into the atmosphere to test whether that actually can reduce the heat from the sun that through the machinations of global warming turns into our trouble. And it gives, even though it's a small amount they're proposing to release, you go, oh well, you know, the metaphor of the slippery slope, here we go. And somewhere we can be sure there's a scientist who sees a Nobel Prize in this in a white coat and is all ready for such an experiment. A detail here before we turn to the small nations. India, this is Bloomberg reporting. India has named its price in high-stakes climate talks. If the rich countries want it to cut planet-warming emissions, they need to come up with $1 trillion, that's the T word, of public cash by the end of the decade. Is there a sense of bidding going on at COP26? If you want me to do this, here's my price.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a huge amount of that. But frankly, as the Indian, as far as the Indians are concerned, dream on. They're not going to get a trillion. They're not, you know, that's just, it's not going to happen. The money, you know, the money is not there in the West, or is certainly not going to be made available to do that. But the Indians, I think, are also pretty foolish talking in these terms, because the World Bank, you know, not a green, woolly, radical, whatever institution, has issued reports suggesting that if we continue on our present trajectories, by the middle of the century, due to climate change and ecological degradation and drought, Indian economic growth will go into reverse. You will have economic decline in India, and hundreds of millions of people, 400 million is the most widely used estimate, will plunge back into deep poverty. In other words, the whole vision of India shining, you know, India becoming the next superpower, economic superpower, but also all these personal, individual, familial Indian hopes of rising from poverty into the middle classes will be dead. People will plunge back from the middle classes, you know, into the ranks of the immiserated poor. Now, the consequences of that for India will be catastrophic. Long, long before they become catastrophic for us, India will be suffering from disaster as a result of climate change. So, you know, the Indians and so many others need to realize that they're absolutely right blaming the West for what has happened. Quite. But that is, saying all this is not going to help them, you know, when they go to hell in three decades' time as a result of climate change. And climate change, by the way, you know, driven so much by Indian and Chinese coal burning.
Let's turn to the Indo-Pacific, the small nations, the island nations, because that part of the world is India and China, Eurasia. Anatole Levin is at COP26 at Glasgow in the Conservative Environment Network proceedings. Very attractive in Glasgow, a famous city, but we're going to the Indo-Pacific next, and what is to be done? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.